From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Guy Pearce. He's now starring in The Time Machine and The Count of Monte Cristo. He played a drag queen in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, a straight-laced cop in L.A. Confidential, and a man with amnesia in Memento. Also, we talk with Chris Waddell. This week, he's competing in the Paralympics in Salt Lake City. He's already won a silver medal to add to the 5 gold medals he's won in previous Paralympic competitions. He broke his back in a skiing accident in 1988. Now he skis on a monoski, a ski attached to a small seat, and he reaches the speed of 70 miles an hour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush held a news conference today, addressing topics ranging from the nation's nuclear arsenal to a muddle over the visas of 2 of the September 11th terrorists. The president expressed his anger at the visa affair, saying it underlines the need for reform at the Immigration and Naturalization Service. 6 months after the attacks, a flight school received confirmation that the visa applications had been approved. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
On Monday, the Huffman Aviation International Flight School received a letter from the INS saying that Mohammed Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi, both pilots in the attacks, had received student visas. To be fair, the applications had been approved last summer, weeks before the attacks, and it had taken 7 months to be processed. But in a news conference, President Bush said the INS clearly needs to be reformed.
It's one of the reasons why I called for the separation of the paperwork side of the INS from the enforcement side. And obviously the paperwork side needs a lot of work.
Attorney General John Ashcroft said he has asked the Justice Department's Inspector General to look into how this could have happened and promised to make the appropriate reforms. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Asked about the Pentagon's current review of nuclear weapons policy, the president said he regards the nation's stock of nuclear weapons as a deterrent to nations that might threaten the nation. The Pentagon review includes the possibility of not destroying all the nuclear weapons that have been decommissioned under an agreement with Russia. The president also responded to questions on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, saying that recent military actions by Israel were not helpful to U.S. efforts to restart the peace process. The president's Mideast peace envoy, Anthony Zinni, is scheduled to leave for the region today in an attempt to arrange a ceasefire. U.S. automakers are applauding the Senate's decision to reject tougher fuel economy standards. Quinn Kleinfelter of member station WDET reports.
American automakers fought against a bipartisan Senate proposal that called for increasing the fuel economy of U.S.-made vehicles by 50% over the next dozen years. Now the Senate has instead adopted a less stringent plan calling for the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to develop fuel mileage standards. A spokesperson for General Motors, Mike Morrissey, says automakers find that appropriate.
A good development for consumers and a good development for the nation's auto workers. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has the experts and is in a unique position to formulate rules.
Some in Congress charge that car makers help tip the debate simply to save themselves money. But car companies counter that the requirements would have forced them to build fragile and overly expensive vehicles, driving consumers to foreign-made brands. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
In stocks, the Dow lost 130 points, the NASDAQ lost 35. This is NPR News. Vice President Dick Cheney discussed the violence between Israel and the Palestinians today in a meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Cheney said that both sides share the burden of ending the violence. Mubarak told reporters that he and Cheney will press the two sides to accept a plan put forward by CIA Director George Tenet and former Senator George Mitchell. The Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Boston says insurance funds will not cover the entire cost of its settlement with people who say they were molested by a former priest. Monica Brady Meyerhoff reports from member station WBUR.
The Catholic Church in Boston may have to sell buildings, take loans, or ask for a special contribution from wealthy donors to help pay for the costly settlement of priest sex abuse cases. Tuesday, the Archdiocese agreed to pay up to $30 million to settle more than 80 sex abuse cases against one former priest. Ken Hokanson is the Chief Development Officer for the Archdiocese. He says no money from parishioner collections will be used.
No funds from the Capital Campaign or the Cardinal's Appeal will be used for the settlement. Money will be used only from those people who have specifically designated their funds for that purpose.
The church is in the middle of a $300 million capital campaign, which has been extended because of the scandal. For NPR News, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov in Boston.
A jury in Atlanta has convicted a former 1960s radical known as H. Rapp Brown of the murder of a sheriff's deputy. The jury sentenced Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin to life in prison without possibility of parole. Prosecutors said Al-Amin killed Deputy Ricky Kinchin as Kinchin and another deputy tried to serve him with an arrest warrant. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Chris Waddell is competing in the Paralympics, the International Olympics for Disabled Athletes, which are underway in Salt Lake City. On Sunday, he won a silver medal for skiing to add to the 5 Paralympic gold medals he's already won for skiing and wheelchair racing. He's competing again today and tomorrow. Waddell lost the use of his legs in 1988 after breaking his back in a ski accident. When he returned to the slopes, it was on a monoski. I spoke with him Monday and asked him to describe the monoski he's using in the Paralympics.
The shock absorber is probably the most important part of the whole thing. And it's a frame that's kind of almost like taking a motorcycle frame without the wheels and without the handlebars. So you sit on this frame about 18 inches off the ground, and my feet are extended in front of me, my knees are bent, and I have outriggers in my arms, in my hands, little like crutches with skis on the bottom. And the great part about it is that if I do things well from the waist up, it basically, the ski does what it's designed to do.
And if not?
If not, I'm not making a very good turn.
Right. Now, you mentioned the shock absorber. How does a shock absorber work? Is it like the shock absorber on a car?
It's exactly the same as a shock absorber on a car. It's actually a motorcycle shock absorber. And the thing is that for a regular able-bodied person skiing, you have your knees, hips, and ankles to absorb the bumps and the various terrain and stuff like that out there. I don't. If I were skiing without a shock absorber on my monoski, it would be, you know, if it were completely solid, it would be a miserably difficult ride. And I've been really lucky. The company that I'm with, Yeti Monoskis, has been working closely with Penske, and that's one of the things that we can continue to improve is the shock and the ability to keep the ski on the snow. And if we're able to do that, then we're able to take advantage of the technology of the actual snow ski.
Now, are you strapped in to the ski?
Oh, yes. Strapped in, buckled in. I have a cover that covers my legs, so it adds to the aerodynamic. Makes it more aerodynamic. And I'm strapped in. I'm at one with the ski. The binding is a regular ski binding that we click into, but it's also pinned with a cotter pin so that it won't release. So I'm with the ski 100% of the time. If I crash, I'm still with the ski, and sometimes that gets a little scary because you're talking about 35 pounds of additional weight, but I don't want to lose the ski. It'd be really ugly if I lost the ski, and things would get really, really ugly.
Now, you're seated on one ski. Why not two skis?
One ski is, I mean, there's some people out there who do buy skis. Most of the buy skis right now are for higher level injuries, higher level paraplegics and quadriplegics, people who don't have as much balance. The one ski for the monoski is just more performance oriented at that point. Right now, one ski just enables us to make a better turn than two skis do, and maybe that'll change in the future. But at this juncture in time, that's the best thing we have going.
How fast can you go?
I did not hear if they had a speed trap at the bottom of the downhill, but one of the guys who's organizing the race was telling me that he was guessing we were going about 70 miles an hour at the bottom there. So it's pretty quick.
Compare that to the speed of a skier who's skiing on their legs.
Well, it depends on which skiers you're comparing that to.
Well, in the Olympics. If you're talking, yeah.
Right. The Olympic, we're finishing at the women's downhill. It's the women's downhill finish, so it's the same pitch. I think they were going close to like 80 to 85. So we were, 10 to 15 miles an hour slower than they were.
Mm-hmm. Still pretty darn fast.
Yeah. Well, fast enough to get your attention.
Now, how do you keep your balance and control your center of gravity on the monoski?
The monoski, what's interesting about it is it's like riding a bicycle, where when you first start out, it's really difficult to find the balance. And especially when you're going slowly, it seems like you're never going to find your balance because, I don't know, it's the same thing on a bicycle where if you're trying to go slowly on a bicycle, it's much more difficult to balance. Once you get going, you find that balance point, and once you've found it, it seems like you're not going to lose it. And so it's really similar to riding a bicycle in that it's pretty easy once you find the balance point.
You first started skiing when you were a child. How old were you?
Right. I was about 3 years old when I first started skiing.
And you were how old when you had your accident?
I was 20 at the time of my accident.
Mm-hmm. So you started skiing when you were about 3. You had your accident when you were about 20. So you were already skiing a lot by then. What are the biggest differences for you between skiing on the monoski and skiing on your legs like you used to do before the accident?
Right. What was interesting is when I first started skiing again in a monoski, it was difficult to learn because I was such a young kid when I first started skiing that I don't remember learning how to ski the first time. And I had always kind of taken it for granted. It was something that I did all the time, every day, 100 days a year or something like that. And so learning to ski again was certainly difficult. What's different is I have one ski. I don't have the ability to step from one foot to the other. I don't have as much of an ability to make a lateral move, so a sideways move to try to gain a little bit of distance, I guess. So to help me get back online, I guess is what I'm saying. So it's much more difficult in some respects that you've got to follow the ski around. You've got to make the ski go through the turn and into the next turn, and so there's not as much of a it's not as much room for error. There's not as much of an opportunity to kind of cheat. You kind of have to figure out where you're going to go and what you're going to do and stick with that line.
How do you stop?
Same way that anybody else would. You just get the ski across the hill, edge a little bit to slow down and stop. It's amazingly similar, and there are times where I've completely forgotten that I'm skiing in a monoski.
Right. I guess what I find most difficult to understand about the sport that you compete in now, and this is, I'll preface this by saying I'm a physical coward.
Okay.
But I think if I took a bad fall and broke my back, that I'd devote the rest of my life to like trying desperately to preserve the movement that I had
what
left.
What you had?
Yeah, and the last thing in the world I would do would be to ski downhill at 70 miles an hour and risk breaking an arm, or anything like that. And obviously, you don't feel that way.
Well, that's actually a really interesting thing that I think a lot of people look at and say, I wouldn't risk this. I wouldn't try. You've already injured yourself. Why do you want to risk anything else? And the hard part is that you want to start over again. That a lot of what was taken away from me was the use of my body, was the use of my legs. And I had to reclaim some pride in my body. I had to reclaim who I was to a certain extent. And I had to prove to myself what was possible. And the fact of the matter is, being an athlete, it makes my life a lot easier. It makes my life a lot easier just getting around on a daily basis. And I think that's what happens for a lot of disabled people. I'm lucky that I work closely with one of my sponsors, with the Hartford Financial Services Group. And that's one of the things that I do for them is represent some of the possibilities that are out there. Because for people who have had a traumatic injury, the hardest part is getting started. And people always ask me, well, what, how do you do it? How are you able to have achieved what you've achieved? And the answer for me is that I found something that I love to do.
How often do you fall when you're skiing?
How often do I fall? It depends on the day. The big thing is that if I don't fall, I'm not pushing myself. Mm-hmm. So in training, I really need to push myself to the point where I am going to fall, where I am going to find that fine line between being in control and being out of control. And if I can find that line, then that's something that I can use when I get into a competition.
Are there any tricks to falling on the monoski without hurting yourself?
Not really, I don't think. I mean, part of it is you are much less likely to get hurt if you're being aggressive, if you're going for it, and if you're relaxed. If you tighten up and you're trying not to fall, that's usually when you get hurt. So being calm and being at ease with the sport, I think oftentimes is makes for good falls.
Right. Have you had any serious injuries since the monoskiing?
I've had a variety of different injuries. I mean, I've broken my nose and strained my rotator cuff, and I've taken some crashes and had some bumps and bruises. I haven't had anything that's really been serious, and I'm certainly knocking on wood at this point and hoping that I avoid that in the future as well.
Now, over the weekend, you won a silver medal.
Yes.
How many fractions of a second did you miss gold by?
I think I missed gold by 29 hundredths of a second.
See, that's such an unfathomable measure of time. I mean, you can't even say by a nose, because a nose is like much bigger than that amount of time is.
I think it ended up being, at that speed, it was 7.8 meters that I lost by over a course that's about 2 miles long.
Oh, I see. So it's really more than by a nose, because you're going so quickly.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we were going about 70 miles an hour at the end of the race there.
Right. So did you feel really, really victorious when you got the silver medal, or were you disappointed that it wasn't gold?
Well, the biggest thing is when I'm competing, I have to look at the competition is between me and myself oftentimes, and between the mountain and me. And really, I felt like I had a good run. I felt like I conquered my fear. I felt like I did what I needed to do. I was disappointed. I felt like I blew one turn close to the end, mm-hmm. and that might very well have been the difference. You're also, when you're competing against other people, you're competing and you're working with the hope of winning. And so, yeah, it's always a little bit disappointing, but the guy who beat me is a great athlete, and I certainly can't take anything away from him. And I put down the best run that I could put down at that point, and that's certainly all I could hope for.
My guest is skier Chris Waddell. He's currently competing in the Paralympics in Salt Lake City. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Chris Waddell is my guest, and he's currently competing in the Paralympics in the skiing events. Can you tell us about the accident in which you got your injury?
I can tell you a little bit about it. I don't remember all of my accident. I broke my back. I was skiing. I was warming up, preparing to train, skiing with some friends at home, and I was testing a new pair of skis. My binding came off prematurely. So I was skiing along. One of my skis popped off. And that's all I remember of the whole thing. I crashed. I don't know what happened after that. The shock made it so that I blacked out, essentially. I was conscious, but I was in shock. And so I don't know what happened. I broke a couple of vertebrae, collarbone, ribs, and stuff like that. And I was kind of in and out for a while as far as what I remember, going to the hospital and then being airlifted to another hospital and stuff like that. But that's what I remember.
Are you grateful you don't remember more?
I think that not remembering, in some ways is a blessing. It probably made it a lot easier to come back to skiing,
mm-hmm.
because I didn't, it's not like I have this classic flashback kind of thing.
Right.
You're thinking, oh no, here we are. I'm in the same position again. I don't remember that. It made it easier to come back to skiing, and maybe in some ways it made it easier to move forward, to progress in my rehabilitation and things like that. At this point in my life, it's not a big deal one way or the other whether I remember or not. Maybe I'll remember. Maybe I'll piece it together at this point, I don't think I'll remember anymore. And I'm fine with that. I don't need it one way or the other, I don't think.
At what point after the accident did you start thinking very seriously about wanting to ski again?
In the time leading up to my accident, I was preparing for ski season. I raced at Middlebury College at the time of my accident, and I was preparing for the ski season. And I had goals as an able-bodied athlete, and that fed right into my life after my accident. I was never told that I was paralyzed. So as I was lying in my hospital bed, I was planning my return to skiing while I was lying in my hospital bed. I didn't know the extent of my injuries. I didn't know how I was going to be able to move forward. But luckily, a couple of opportunities presented themselves. A friend of a friend was doing a documentary movie on adaptive skiing, and she asked me if I'd be willing to ski in it. My coach at Middlebury, Bart Bradford, had been coaching at Mount Hood and ended up coaching right next to the U.S. disabled team, and came back all excited and through the friends of Middlebury Skiing bought me my first monoski, which goes between $2,000 and $3,000. So I was lucky that I had a tremendous amount of support, and I was able to get back into skiing really quickly and really easily.
So when did you realize your legs were paralyzed? Is it something you figured out yourself, or did someone actually tell you?
Nobody ever told me. Did I? I think I figured it out, but I think there's also, for me, there was a little bit of the ego of an athlete at that point, where maybe I was paralyzed at that point, and I figured that what applied to other people was not necessarily going to apply to me. And so whether that was the situation at this point or not, I thought that I could overcome it. And that was not necessarily the case, but I think that got me through some of the hard part, some of the part of looking at this huge traumatic change in my life and being able to say, you know what, I need to start working now, and eventually I will overcome this whole thing. And maybe I didn't overcome it in a literal way, but I think in a pretty figurative way I was able to overcome it by finding ways for me to go forward.
You need incredible upper body strength for the mono skiing that you did. What was your approach to building up your upper body strength after you lost the movement of your legs?
When I got back into skiing, I wanted to be a world-class athlete. I wanted to be the best mono skier in the world. And that was my goal. And I figured that if I was going to try to achieve that goal, I needed to train like the best athlete in the world. So I started racing wheelchairs, which is the best way, one of the best ways I can think of to build up my upper body. And so I started racing wheelchairs, and that was my off-season training that quickly snowballed into being a sport on its own. So I've actually competed in the last two summer games in addition to the last three winter games. I guess this is my fourth winter game. So it really, my off-season training is an off-season sport that prepares me really well for the winter. I'm fit and ready to go by the time November comes around.
Did you work out with weights?
I work out with weights. I'm in the gym. Like this past summer, I was in the gym 5 to 6 days a week usually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think one of the most amazing things about being a disabled athlete like you are, I mean, a lot of people assume when they see somebody, for instance, in a wheelchair, that they must be very weak, that they're a constant need of assistance of some sort. And you're right. Really strong. I mean, you can't use your legs, but, right. You know, the parts of the body you can use are really fit. So it's this kind of paradox for somebody encountering you. You know, part of you doesn't work, but the other part is, you know, really top notch.
Right. Well, see, the fact of the matter is there's certainly – it's not to say that there aren't things that are difficult, because there are difficulties that I encounter every single day. And, you know, it's a matter of – I mean, a flight of stairs is a difficulty. Getting up a curb when I have something on my lap is a difficulty. And so there are a variety of things that certainly are difficult. But they're also by virtue of being fit, it's a matter of being creative for me. It's a matter of trying to figure out – how I can achieve what I want to achieve. And sure, some things are going to take a lot longer. It's difficult for me to put skis in the rooftop box on my car, but I figured out that I can sit on the roof and pull my skis up and put them in the box. And it's a lot easier if I get somebody else to do it, but if the situation calls for it, I can do it myself. And I think that that's part of what being an athlete is, and it's part of you know, getting the most out of life, I guess.
You've competed in and won medals in several Paralympics. When you were a teenager, did you compete with the goal of ultimately getting in the Olympics?
I don't know that it was the goal. It was a dream, and by the time I was a teenager, it wasn't all that realistic a dream. I don't think I was not going to compete in the Olympics. That is one of the things that really, in a lot of ways, is a paradox for me, because I've risen to a much higher level after a traumatic injury, which I think probably wouldn't make sense to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, it was a dream as a kid to be in the Olympics. It was never a realistic dream. Luckily now I can say that I've been in, and this is my sixth Paralympic Games, and I can say that on a few days I've been the best in the world, and I never, ever could have said that prior to my injury. So it's a very strange twist of fate.
Now, you said that you don't think you're going to be an athlete all your life. Do you feel that there's a certain limit, like there's a certain age that you'll reach and then you'll have to decide that's it?
Well, it's all an individual thing, I think. I think there are people who certainly have been successful throughout their 30s into their 40s. And it's a matter of what you determine you want to do. I've been an athlete for a long time in my life, and I think there comes a point when you decide that even if you can continue to be successful, there are other things that you want to pursue. And I think that I will come to that point at some point, and I haven't decided exactly when that'll be.
What do you think you would do afterwards?
That's a tough question.
Mm-hmm.
That's in a lot of ways, I feel like I'm kind of approaching the end of my athletic career, and I feel like a college senior at this point. And people are asking me, what am I going to do? And I don't know exactly what I'm going to do. I don't have a firm plan of what I'm going to do. And part of it is that I think there are a lot of possibilities out there, and I want to continue to pursue some of those things. I've done a fair amount of speaking, motivational type speaking, and I'm sure that's something that I would continue to do in the future. That's something I very much enjoy. And I think that'll be, I don't know if that'll be all of what I do, but it'll be a component. I've done some television work. I've been on camera doing some television work. I'd certainly love to continue to do that. And a lot of it depends on what the opportunities are that present themselves.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. Appreciate it.
Chris Waddell is competing in the Paralympics in Salt Lake City. He won a silver medal on Sunday. Our interview was recorded on Monday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Love, Greg and Lauren, a husband's day-by-day account of his wife's remarkable recovery. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Guy Pearce. He's starring in two films playing in theaters now, The Count of Monte Cristo and The Time Machine. He also starred in Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, L.A. Confidential, and Memento. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Guy Pearce, first became known to Americans for his role as a drag queen in the comedy Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. The Australian actor went on to star in the cop drama L.A. Confidential. In last year's independent film hit Memento, he played a man with a rare form of amnesia. Now Pearce is in two films currently in theaters, The Count of Monte Cristo and The Time Machine. Let's start with a scene from The Time Machine. Pearce plays a scientist at the dawn of the 20th century who invents a time machine. In this scene, he's traveled to the year 2030, where he meets a computerized hologram in the form of a human, which is a databank of the world's knowledge. The time traveler has some questions for the hologram, which is played by Orlando Jones.
Do you know anything about physics?
Ah, accessing physics.
Mechanical engineering. Dimensional optics, phonography, temporal causality, temporal paradox.
Time travel?
Yes.
Accessing science fiction?
No, practical application. My question is, why can't one change the past?
Because one cannot travel into the past.
What if one could?
One cannot.
Excuse me, this is something you should trust me on.
Soon after this encounter, Pearce gets back into the time machine and eventually lands 800,000 years into the future, where he finds that humans are the prey of underworld creatures that he will soon have to battle. Now, one of the things I imagine you don't learn in acting classes is how to wrestle with monsters or creatures in a movie.
So, if I had of, I wouldn't have broken my rib doing it.
Oh, did you break a rib doing it?
Yes, I did.
What happened?
Well, I just have to run in and attack one of these monsters and one of these Morlocks. And after having done it about 15 or 20 times, I started to realize I was in a serious amount of pain and had actually cracked one of my left front ribs, so it was most uncomfortable for a while after that.
Could you keep shooting?
Well, we did. I mean, I had to sort of pare down what I had to do, and ironically, it was around the time that Simon, our director, needed to sort of step away from the shoot, and so when he did that, we ended up having a 2-week break while the replacement, the sort of temporary replacement director came in, you know. So it actually worked out quite well that I could have 2 weeks of sitting around at home without trying to climb towers and wrestle more Morlocks, you know.
I was reading some article about the making of Time Machine, and it was, I think it was a studio executive maybe, who said that they had a feeling that although you hadn't done this kind of film before, that you could really be a hero. I thought, look, okay, when you take on a role, and you really are the hero in this. I mean, you save a whole race of people. How did you prepare yourself to play the part of the pure hero?
It's stepping out of, I suppose, the reality of what a person does. I mean, it's funny in a way, because I don't consider myself at all to be heroic, and I think it's a term that gets used far more in the United States than it does in Australia, and so it's an unusual term for me, hero. You know, I remember in LA Confidential, in that final sort of speech that I have when I'm sitting in the interrogation room, I have to say to the guys, you know, you'll have to find another hero, and I'm kind of talking about myself, and I remember having to try and really understand what that meant, you know. And it's about cultivating the childlike quality within your mind or your imagination or your perspective that enables you to be able to look at people as heroes or bad guys or whatever. You know, to me, there is a sort of a naive childlike quality to that viewpoint, you know.
Let me ask you about Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. This is the movie that Americans first got to know you through.
And yes, I guess so.
In this part, you play a drag queen. The premise of the movie is that one of your friends who is a drag queen gets a part in a drag show at a resort in a town in the remote Australian desert. So this friend invites you and another friend who's a transsexual, played by Terrence Stamp, to go with him. So the movie is like your journey across the outback in this old bus that you name Priscilla. Let me play a short scene. In this scene, The transsexual, played by Terrence Stamp, is not very happy that you were invited along. The scene opens with you singing.
A desert holiday, let's pack the drag away. You take the lunch and tea, I'll take the ecstasy. F*** off, you silly queer, I'm getting out of here. A desert holiday, hip, 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 hooray.
Why? Why not?
Look, he's turned into a bloody good little performer.
That's right. A bloody good little performer. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I thought we were getting away from all this shit.
Two's company, three's a party, Bernadette, my sweet.
We're unplugging our curling wands and going bush, Felicia. Why would you possibly want to leave all this glamour for a hike into the middle of nowhere?
Do you really want to know?
Desperately.
Well, ever since I was a lad, I've had this dream. A dream that I now, finally, have a chance to fulfill.
And that is?
To travel to the center of Australia, climb King's Canyon as a queen, in a full-length Gautier sequin, heels and a tiara.
So, Guy Pearce, what are the favorite costumes that you actually did have to wear for Priscilla?
I think one of the funniest ones, or the funniest situation really, was the when we finally arrive in King's Canyon and we are there on the top of the this precipice that was really quite high. We were unable to hike up there. We had to actually be flown up there by a helicopter and dropped off. And I was wearing a fluffy white G-string and a funny fluffy hat. And sitting on the outside of the helicopter, I wasn't even inside the helicopter, to sit outside on this bar on the outside of it being flown up into King's Canyon. So I have a really unusual memory of that costume and how uncomfortable it is to sit on the outside of a helicopter in a fluffy white G-string. But they were all brilliant, really. I mean, they were such fabulous additions, I suppose, and helpful elements to our characters. They were great.
What was it like for you to wear drag? I mean, did it bring out certain, like, different parts of your personality? Did you automatically start walking differently, talking differently?
I think so. I mean, we... In some ways, it's about needing to shed any masculinity in a way when you're wearing that garb, because that then becomes kind of comical, I suppose, you know. We actually, when we first did our camera tests and makeup and wardrobe tests, we had all decided prior to that that we were going to go out in Sydney in drag that night, go to some clubs, get drunk and have a fab old time, you know. And which we did. And it was really the first time. We'd been in rehearsals for a couple of weeks, but we'd been wearing jeans and tracksuits and whatever, you know. And so it was the first time that it really came to life. And so much of that is about in wearing those costumes and those shoes and the wigs and everything. And just, I suppose, you know, I mean, being an actor in Australia and being recognised, when you're in drag, you're in disguise as well, and so you suddenly feel inconspicuous, so you can kind of get away with doing whatever you want, you know.
My guest is actor Guy Pearce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Guy Pearce, and he's now starring in The Time Machine. Well, Guy Pearce, let me get to another one of your roles, and this is in the film L.A. Confidential. Mm-hmm. And in this you play Ed Exley, a cop who's pretty clean-cut and self-righteous and very butch, not at all like your role in Priscilla. And you're very ambitious, and you're willing to do anything to get ahead, as long as it's by the book. And your ambition and your kind of political know-how make you unpopular with a lot of your colleagues. You get a promotion for supposedly solving a mass murder at the Night Owl Diner, but as more evidence surfaces, you begin to think you got the wrong guys. And in this scene, you want to reinvestigate that murder, and you're seeking the help of a fellow cop played by Kevin Spacey.
Do you make the three Negroes for the Night Owl killings?
What?
It's a simple question.
Why in the world do you want to go digging any deeper into the Night Owl killings, Lieutenant?
Rollo Tomasi.
Is there more to that, or am I supposed to guess?
Rollo was a purse snatcher. My father ran into him off duty. And he shot my father 6 times and got away clean. No one even knew who he was. I just made the name up to give him some personality.
What's your point?
Rollo Tomasi's the reason I became a cop. I wanted to catch the guys who thought they could get away with it. It was supposed to be about justice. Then somewhere along the way, I lost sight of that. Why'd you become a cop?
I don't remember. What do you want, Exley?
I just want to solve this thing.
Night Owl was solved.
No. I want to do it right.
That's my guest, Guy Pearce, along with Kevin Spacey, in a scene from L.A. Confidential. Now, Russell Crowe was also in this movie with you. So here you have a movie set in L.A., and two of the stars are Australian, you and Russell Crowe. How did that happen?
Well, if you really want to get technical about it, I'm actually English, and Russell's from New Zealand. So,
You were born in England. That's true.
Yeah, I was born in England. Russell was born in New Zealand, and I grew up in Australia from the age of 3, and I think Russell came to Australia when he was about 21.
Huh.
So yes, we're Aussies.
Right. So, did you have to convince Curtis Hanson, the director of LA Confidential, that you could sound quite American?
Well, obviously I had to, and that just occurred in the original reading that I went to. I was literally just one of however many people coming in to screen test, and I found by that point, that was early in 96, and I'd spent, a couple of visits throughout 95 going to meetings and auditioning for people and this, that and the other, and one of the interesting things was that every time I went to a meeting and spoke the way I normally speak, it seemed to cause a bit of difficulty for people because they would say, you might be able to work in this country, but you're going to have to lose that accent. So I started going to meetings and readings and just affecting an American accent.
So for you, what defines an American sound? To me, as someone who really only speaks English, it's all I know is American English. And that seems to be like the basic to me. For you, it's something different that you have to learn. What defines American English to you as opposed to Australian English?
There are so many different kind of American accents and different kind of Australian accent. It's hard to say. I guess the first and most obvious general thing is the R sound. You would say car and we would say car. And that is the most basic, as I say, in sort of simple difference. But funnily enough, there are some similarities, I guess, in tone and pitch and melody between, say, the Southern American accents, the sort of Texas, the slang, the slow kind of, the laconic kind of quality, to some of the Northern Australian accents. The Queenslanders up there kind of talk like that, there are different shapes of words and sounds, but there are many places that actually have great similarities, but it could just be that simple thing, as I say, of saying R instead of R.
Did you have a language coach, or did you just pick this up on your own?
Oh, look, we watch so much American television as kids in Australia and so many American films that you become quite attuned to it,
Did you know Russell Crowe before L.A. Confidential?
Not very well. Russell had come and done a guest spot on a TV show that I did back in 85. And then the last time I'd seen Russell, he headbutted me in a bar in Sydney in about 1992, I think. I didn't know him very well.
Right. Why did Russell Crowe headbutt you?
I asked him that very same question, and he said he was trying to get my attention.
There are other ways.
Yes, but not as unpredictable as a headbutt.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Guy Pearce, and his films include Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, L.A. Confidential, Memento, The Count of Monte Cristo, and now The Time Machine. You were born in England, but you grew up in Australia. What brought your family from England to Australia?
My father was a fairly well-renowned test pilot in the UK. He'd worked in the Royal Air Force and worked for Hawker Siddeley. He was the chief test pilot for the Harrier jump jet and had also worked as a test pilot for the Canberra, Lockheed Lightning and various other fairly well-renowned aircraft. I think at the time we were in the UK living in Bristol, he was offered a job as the chief test pilot for the government aircraft factories in Australia to test a new aircraft, which was a short takeoff and landing aircraft called the Nomad. We took the job. He took the job. It was really just for a two-year stint. But after that 2 years, Mum, who was from England, and my dad, who was originally from New Zealand, didn't want to go back to England. They decided that, you know, Australia was more in line with the kind of life they wanted to live. So we stayed in Australia, and then that was in about 1971, and Dad was then killed testing an aircraft in 76, but we obviously still stayed in Australia.
When your father was killed testing an aircraft, what happened? The plane crashed?
Yeah, it was they were testing a new long version of the aircraft. It literally took off. It was in the air for about 90 seconds. And due to sort of government pressures, they had to test these aircraft prior to them actually being ready to be tested. They usually go through a series of wind tunnel tests, et cetera, before they take them up in the air. So they took this aircraft up in the air, 90 seconds in the air. Most of the tail came off, and, of course, the aircraft just plummeted immediately and my father and the designer were killed, and the navigator is now, unfortunately, he's still alive, but unfortunately is a paraplegic.
Had you braced yourself for something like that?
No, I was eight. I hadn't really conceived of such a notion, I suppose, until it actually occurred.
What impact did it leave you very afraid? Obviously, I'm sure you're very shaken up that you'd lost your father, but in terms of your own actions, did it leave you afraid to try new things? Because, like, look what happened to your father. He was killed on the job doing something adventurous.
I think it actually, in a rather morbid way, probably makes one more of a daredevil in when it comes to taking risks or whatever. And that's, as I say, from a sort of a morbid perspective. I mean, there's a desperate part of me that is trying to understand who my father was. And the fact that he went to that extreme and ended up dying because of it, I guess does kind of make you have a rather morbid fascination with extremes. I mean, I certainly don't have a fear of flying. I fly all the time and I really enjoy it. And funnily enough, after Dad died, I remember my mother saying to me, "Oh, you're such a responsible young boy, you're so responsible." And I've got an intellectually disabled sister, and there's really just the three of us, my mum and Tracy, my sister and I. And so from a very young age, I was placed in the seat of responsibility, I suppose, in regard to taking care of myself and taking care of my sister. And I don't know, I guess in conjunction with that, or as a balance to that, there's a part of me that wants to let go of that responsibility and go and take risks. And of course, you know, being on stage in front of people or being in films that are presented to lots of people is not life-threatening, but it's certainly risk-taking to a certain extent.
My guest is Guy Pearce. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Guy Pearce. He starred in last year's independent film hit Memento, which is nominated for an Oscar for Best Screenplay. Pearce plays Leonard Shelby, a man who is trying to find out who murdered his wife, but the trauma has left him with a rare form of amnesia that prevents him from making new memories. Here he is with a shadowy figure who is helping him, played by Joe Pantoliano.
Leonard, look, you have to be very careful.
Why?
The other day you mentioned that maybe somebody was trying to set you up, get you to kill the wrong guy.
Oh, well, I go on facts, not recommendations, but thank you.
Lenny, you can't trust a man's life to your little notes and pictures.
Why not?
Because your notes could be unreliable.
Memory's unreliable.
Oh, please.
No, really. Memory's not perfect. It's not even that good. Ask the police. Eyewitness testimony is unreliable. The cops don't catch a killer by sitting around remembering stuff.
Right.
They collect facts.
That's not what I'm saying.
They make notes and they draw conclusions. Facts, not memories. That's how you investigate. I know. It's what I used to do. Look, memory can change the shape of a room. It can change the color of a car. And memories can be distorted. They're just an interpretation. They're not a record. And they're irrelevant if you have the facts.
You really want to get this guy, don't you?
Killed my wife. He took away my memory. He destroyed my ability to live.
How did you know you wanted to act?
The only recollection I really have was from a very young age, probably about that time, 8, 9, 10. My mother used to take me to a lot of theatre. She was a big fan of theatre. And we would go and see all sorts of a variety of stuff. And I feel like I have this memory as a kid of watching these productions and wanting to be up there affecting people the way I was being affected by the characters on stage. Wanting to... I suppose, was so moved by the conviction that those characters had in the performance that they were doing,
but
found that incredibly appealing.
But at the age of 16, you won a state bodybuilding championship. Why were you heading in that direction, and how big were those muscles?
Not so big. Well, I started, yet again, this is, I guess it was another influence of my mother. She started going to the gym when I was about 14 or 15, and I just went along with her. I mean, I played group sport at school, but I was very much an individual and very much spent a lot of time on my own or with my sister. And so I started going to this gym and just started working out and just trying to get fit, you know. And the gym that we went to was owned and was run by a married couple who were, one, she was a runner-up Miss Universe a couple of times, and the husband, Joe, was a judge for the IFBB, the International Federation of Bodybuilding. So I was quite exposed to the world of bodybuilding at a pretty young age, and he basically would say to me, the work that you're doing, the physical work you're doing, is having quite an amazing immediate response, and, you know, if you want to consider it, then, you know, we should enter you in some competitions. And, you know, I saw competitions and I would see the videos of these competitions. And to me, it was kind of, I guess, yet another form of being on stage and performing, you know. And I was fascinated with the whole notion of actually creating yourself. And I still am, not so much in actually bodybuilding, but I'm more interested in spiritually creating or developing yourself or physically, you know, creating yourself in the characters that I play.
Yeah, but if you spiritually develop yourself, you can't show off, like, if you've got lots of muscles.
No, that's right. Hence the reason why I'm not so interested in bodybuilding anymore.
So do you still have muscles as big as they were then, or did you let them...
No, well, you saw Memento. I didn't have my shirt on much in that. You know, I certainly...
Well, after seeing your cheekbones, you know, I was going to tell you, you need to eat more.
I get told that all the time, so I'm kind of used to that now.
Now, when you were 18, you were cast in a nighttime soap opera in Australia called Neighbours. I have not seen the show. I doubt many Americans have. I read that you became a teen heartthrob. Fair description?
Well, to a certain extent. I mean, you know, I think, you know, the dog on the show is really popular as well. So, I mean, it's just that thing of being on a show that's watched by lots of teenagers. They tend to get a big excited about seeing you in real life. Or you know, there was obviously a lot of stuff with us on magazine covers, etc. You know, there was a bunch of us in the show. It wasn't like it was just me or anything.
Right, right. Well, you know, when you're a star at that age and teenagers fantasize about you, I'm sure they fantasize about this just incredibly interesting, constantly, you know, very sexy kind of life. Did you often think about what your real life was like compared to what your fans were probably imagining your life was like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was a complete loner, you know. I mean, I spent a lot of time at home on my own and really didn't have a great social life. And I found that going out in public was even more difficult then than it was when I was even younger, because suddenly I would get recognised and hassled and confronted or just questioned, or I just didn't deal with the intention very well, I suppose. And so I then started to cultivate a really sort of small, intimate group of friends, and I would spend a lot of time at home on my own. And music has been a really important part of my life, so I really spend a lot of time recording music at home and working in my studio and rehearsing music, etc. So that's what I did.
And is this music singing, playing, both?
Singing primarily, but playing, dabbling in a variety of instruments, and I became very interested in the notion of recording and the sort of technical aspect of recording and arranging. And I would have other musicians come over and play, and you know, that still goes on. Really, it's like a glorified hobby.
But you don't have a CD, a professional CD, right?
No. And I don't, you know, it's funny, as the years go on, the need to actually get it out publicly like that is sort of diminishes, I guess. I mean, I play gigs at home and just random stuff, you know. The nice thing about it is it actually makes one really question why music is such an important part of one's life, and why one feels the need to express, you know, why I feel the need to express myself through music. And it is just about that, expressing myself through music and playing music with other people and rehearsing with other people or recording, but not turning it into, not taking it into that public arena and sort of turning yourself into a known entity because of it, you know.
Well, Guy Pearce, thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Guy Pearce is now starring in The Time Machine and The Count of Monte Cristo. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Avalon Travel Publishing, publisher of Moon Handbook's Travel Guides to Asia, the Pacific, and the Americas, on the web at moon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Haas, a timpani player who's bringing the timpani to the front of the orchestra and the bandstand. He's rediscovered early classical and jazz compositions for timpani and commissioned Philip Glass to write a concerto for timpani. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.